Okay. Good morning. Good to see you. Good to see you too. Thank you, Antasha. Good to see lots of familiar faces and some unfamiliar faces. So really warm welcome if this is your first time here, or you're new here, or you're visiting. So lovely to see you. I'm in the middle of a series on the Sermon on the Mount, the sermon, perhaps the sermon that has ever been preached by Jesus, and it's found in Matthew chapter 5 through to chapter 7. I did have a little bit of a couple of years break, but we started this in 2009. And we've got to Matthew chapter 5 and verse 38. And one of my passions is to allow Scripture to really shape us. And I think when we dabble in Scripture, when we kind of like a stone across water and skirt across it very quickly, we almost don't allow the Scripture to do its work deep in our hearts and in our minds and shape our thinking and shape the way in which we live. And so we are dwelling in these scriptures. We're taking many weeks and months over each one. And the hope is that it can shape us as people that will live for Jesus. And we haven't got there, but right at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus talks about these two paths that we can walk down. There's this very broad path that many people walk down, but it leads to destruction. And then there is this very narrow path. It's the road less traveled. There are very few people that travel down it, but it's the road to life. And I think what Jesus is talking about there is about how we live now. And all that he has taught in the previous chapters is about what path do you want to walk down? Do you want to walk down this broad path where you don't resolve your differences with people and leave your gift at the altar, where you use people for your sexual gratification, where you don't let your yes be yes and your no be no and tell the truth, or when you do take revenge? And he's saying, you can do those things, but that's a very broad path, and many people walk down that path, but it leads to destruction. Or here is this narrow path that you can walk down, and it leads to life, but it means forgiving, loving your enemies, forgiving, reconciling, not using people for your own ends and gratification, particularly in a sexual way. It means truth-telling, even when that costs. It means being faithful to your word, to what you say you will do. And so that's the invitation that Jesus is inviting us down, I believe, in the Sermon on the Mount. And his passion, I think what Jesus' passion here is to create a community or communities of people that will live in light of heaven that is coming to earth and will come in all its fullness. The word that Jesus uses for that most often is the word kingdom. He's saying the kingdom has come. Jesus, as the king, is inaugurating a whole new way of living, and he wants to create communities of people that live in light of that. And he's saying, you will be a light that shines on a hill when you live like this. You'll be totally different from the world and the values of the world that are around you. And if you live like this, you are somehow shining the light of the kingdom that is coming and will come in all its fullness. And so that's what Jesus is doing here in these passages. He's talking to people like you and me, and he's saying, walk down this path, this narrow path, and if you walk down that path, you will be a light that shines on a hill. You will be one of these communities that I'm creating all around the world that will live in light of heaven that is coming and has come. So that's what Jesus is doing. And now we turn again to Matthew chapter 5 and verse 38. Let's read this. I'm reading from the contemporary English version. Actually, let's read that and then we'll go back a slide, Kurt. I've got them in the wrong order. So let's read this scripture. You know that you have been taught an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I tell you not to try to get even with a person who has something, who has done something to you. When someone slaps your right cheek, turn and let that person slap the other cheek. If someone sues you for your shirt, give up your coat as well. If a soldier forces you to carry his pack 1 mile, carry it 2 miles. When people ask you for something, give it to them. When they want to borrow money, lend it to them. And so this is a whole passage around peacemaking. This is the seventh sermon that I've done on this passage. Some of them were a couple of years ago, and then one last time. And there is this quote from a Catholic writer that has inspired me. If you could just flip back the slide here. There is no peace because there are no peacemakers. There are no makers of peace because the making of peace is at least as costly as the making of war. So one of the things that I dream about is churches being places of reconciliation. I'm increasingly training and being involved in training leaders, training church leaders, doing stuff around peacemaking and conflict and how to conflict well. And it distresses me enormously when in marriages or in churches or in communities, Christian communities, in leadership, there is division because we don't know how to dwell in harmony and peace with one another, to love in the midst of difference. And I think it is incredibly costly, but that is our call, to be peacemakers in a world of conflict and war and violence and aggression. To make peace in the midst of difference. And that's my passion, and that's what I want to try and communicate a little bit today. So, we've dwelt in this passage, we've done a lot of exegesis. If you want to look at the exegesis of it, you need to go back to some of the other sermons. I will do it very briefly today. But what I want us to do is to look at this passage through the eyes of power. Last time we looked at the passage through the eyes of people, and we recognized that in the midst of disagreement, in the midst of conflict or difference or tension between people, one of the things that tends to happen is we tend to dehumanize people. We tend to make them less human. And this, at the most extreme end of this, in violent warfare, we call collateral damage when people get killed who aren't armed forces. We call it collateral damage because to call them human beings, to call them mums and dads and babies and children and young girls and young boys is too painful. It's too difficult for us to do that kind of thing. So it's collateral damage. There are unfortunate consequences of the war that we are waging in whatever way it is. And my belief is that violence begets violence. We just see that in the news last night with the Taliban guy that was killed by a US drone strike, and now people are saying this has derailed the whole peace process that was beginning to emerge in Pakistan between the Taliban and the Pakistan parliament. Violence begets violence. It doesn't make peace. Jesus offers us a different way, and that's what I want us to look at today. So we're going to look at this passage not through the eyes of people, but through the eyes of power. So, let's run through this passage very quickly. Are you with me? It's all very quiet. Yep. Okay. So, each of these passages has a threefold pattern to them. We've looked at this again. Firstly, Jesus says, "You have heard it said." That's the traditional teaching, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. Then he names the vicious cycle. This is what happens if you actually engage in this kind of behavior. This is how things spiral downwards. So, and then he offers some examples of transforming actions. If you do these things, it will change. It will change you, might change the relationship with other people. So do these things. And this is the threefold pattern that we find in this passage here. So to start with, you have the traditional teaching. You know that you have been taught. Truly, I say to you, different translations will say this, Jesus introduces this lex talionis, this law of equal retribution, an eye for an eye. It was designed to limit retribution so that if somebody stole £10 off me, I didn't chop their arm off. I just stole £10 back. It was to limit retribution. It was a forward step in the culture of the day. But Jesus, then in verse 39, but I tell you, Jesus goes on, I tell you not to try to get even with a person who's done something to you. What he names is this vicious cycle, that even if you try and get some kind of revenge, if somebody steals £10 and you take £10 back, what happens is that they take £20. And then you take £20, and then they take £50, and so you take £50. What often happens, mostly happens, is this vicious cycle of revenge and retribution. That people don't stick with an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, equal retribution. It escalates and it grows. And we see this in all kinds of conflicts. It's not just stealing or armed conflict. It's difference in between husbands and wives and flatmates and parents and children and work colleagues and in all of our communities. Jesus names this vicious cycle. And then Jesus goes on and he gives four examples of actions that transform. If you do these things, Jesus is saying, if you do these things, it will change you. And I want to look at these four actions through the lens of power and think about the power that is at work in each of these four examples. The first example, when somebody slaps your right cheek, turn and let that person slap your other cheek. As we've said before, if you were to slap somebody's right cheek, the only way you can really do it is with a backhand slap. I can't slap very easily with a front hand slap on somebody's right cheek. It's a backhand slap. That denoted a shaming. It was a way of slapping somebody who had less status or less power. It was the kind of thing that a master would do to a slave. It was designed to humiliate, not necessarily designed to hurt. But the whole point of it was to say, I am more powerful than you. You have no power. And Jesus invites the person then to say, well, if somebody slaps you on that right cheek, if they're saying, I am more powerful, I am more important, I own you in some way, by slapping you on the right cheek, turn the other cheek. The only way I can do that is by a punch or a hit on the left cheek, which would denote equality. It would denote in some way that the power had changed. Jesus, so let's just think about this. Here we have somebody who feels powerless. Maybe they were a slave, and maybe it was the master that was hitting them. And Jesus invites them to turn the other cheek. And in that way, he's saying, see the power that you really have. You have some power here. You are not powerless. And to see that they have some dignity as human beings. He invites the person to change the dynamic of power in the relationship. The next verse, if somebody sues you for your shirt, give them your coat as well. So the man who's being sued, really, for all that he owned. He didn't have anything else to be sued for. He only owned two garments. One was a cloak and one was his kind of undergarments, his like shirt or his underwear or that kind of thing. And he's being sued for his undergarments. So the only thing that he would then own is his cloak. So Jesus, so here we have a power. Who has all the power? The person who is suing. The implication of this example seems to be that the person suing had a right to sue. The law was on his side, but Jesus is naming the injustice that's going on here. The person being sued had no power. It seems like he was going to be taken. All his clothes were going to be taken and just left with his cloak. So Jesus says, give the cloak as well. so that he is left naked with nothing. Now, the shame in that culture was not being naked, but looking on nakedness. So Jesus invites the person to say, here, in the face of maybe what was legally okay, but morally not okay, give him your cloak, show him and expose the injustice for what is going on, and change the power. This person might have felt powerless. The law was against them. There was nothing that I could do. By giving the cloak, suddenly, Jesus was empowering this person, saying, you have some power. You can change what's going on here. Let's look at the next one. The soldier forces you to carry his pack 1 mile. So carry it too. Here, they are the Romans are an occupying force. Israel are in... they are occupied by this foreign army. And this was hated. And the practice was that the soldiers could force people to carry their big weight packs with all their food and belongings and ammunition and everything that they had. And they could, but to limit the abuse of these privileges that soldiers could get the local population to carry their packs, they said, no, you can only do it for 1 mile. And this was a despised practice in that culture. Again, notice who has the power. The soldier has all the power. They were able to, both by force and by law, to get people to carry their packs for 1 mile. This poor person might have been making dinner or taking the kids to school or whatever it was, and all they had to do is just drop everything and go with the soldier for 1 mile, take their weighty packs. They had no power. They might have thought that they were powerless, but Jesus invites them to see the power that they really have, and he invites them to take the pack 2 miles. Go, no, we don't need to stop here. We can go, I can go on. And suddenly the soldier's going, no. I'm only allowed to do it for 1 mile. If you go 2 miles, I could get into trouble. Notice how the power has changed. Jesus, again, is trying to empower those that see themselves as powerless. The final one. The final example has been very misunderstood, I think, because Jesus changes the focus in this particular verse. When people ask you for something, give it to them. When they want to borrow money, lend it to them. I said last time, we need to interpret this verse in light of the fact that this is about do not take revenge, do not retaliate, do not repay evil with evil. So the context here is something has happened that has offended somebody who, in this case, they're the powerful ones. They have the money, the ability to lend and give. They have possessions. And Jesus is saying, where you have been offended and you have status, you have power, you have things at your disposal, act in generosity to the person who has offended you and hurt you. Don't use them. Don't use your power to get revenge in some way, but use your power for their benefit and their blessing. It's an open attitude to give and share with those who have wronged us. Not to retaliate, to defend or withdraw, but to meet injustice with unmerited generosity. And to use our power and our influence for the benefit of other people. So this final scenario, in contrast to the first three, where Jesus is trying to empower those that see themselves as powerless, Jesus is inviting the one who sees themselves as powerful to use their power for the benefit of other people. I want us to notice that in each of the situations Jesus gives, there is a power element to each scenario. Mostly it is the wronged one who is the least powerful. But as I said in the last one, it is the wronged one is the most powerful. When we have been wronged in some way, What's our natural response? What do we tend to want to do when we have been wronged in some way? Fight? Or? Or maybe get even, yeah? Or? Which is perhaps the fighting. I'm off! We tend to want to fight or flight. For me, if I feel I'm backed into a corner, it's when I'm most likely to get aggressive. I revert to being my little 12-year-old self. Come on, then. Try it. It's not very nice. But if I feel I'm being backed into a corner, that's when I'm most likely to get really aggressive. Your response may be different. Sometimes we just get me out of there. When we don't have power, sometimes that's when people get the most aggressive, want to get even in some way, and to use what little power they might have in illegitimate ways. But also, when I have power and I have been wronged, I don't know about you, but the temptation deep in me is to use my power to get even. Am I the only one? When somebody really hurts me and I have power in some way, the temptation, I would suggest, in many of our hearts, maybe all of our hearts, is to use our power in illegitimate ways to get even. But Jesus calls us to a different way. Now, power is not something that you hear very often talked about in church, is it? It's not something we talk about very often. It's almost a dirty word, particularly in our culture. I grew up with a little statement by a chap called Lord Alton, which I'm sure many of us will be familiar with. And it was almost a mantra in our house. All power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. All power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And I would say that in our culture, in general, we're deeply suspicious of power. I would say particularly nowadays. In the last 20 years, those that have power or authority in our culture, we're deeply, deeply suspicious. Politicians. They've abused their power. Bankers, churches, institutions of all kinds. We recognize that power, they've had power, and that power has been used in illegitimate ways and has corrupted. Police, teachers, parents. You only have to read the newspapers or look at the news to see how the media, in fact, the media is another one, with Andy Coulson and Rebecca Brooks, abusing the power that they've had in ways that I find, or possibly, it is alleged. It is alleged. It is alleged that various people have abused the power in ways that I find deeply shocking. To tap into young girls' phones who are missing? Really? We have enough stories in our culture that would reinforce this statement that all power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And I would suggest that it leaves us deeply cynical about power. For me, when I was a young Christian, the only times that we really talked about power was using a slightly different word, but probably very synonymous, the word authority. And mostly it was about the authority that church leaders have and the requirement for everybody else in the church to submit to that authority, to do what they were told. And that, for me, became very distressing and painful and something that I didn't agree with. And that was pretty much what we talked about in terms of power. And I walked massively away from that understanding, thinking, I've seen the abuse of that kind of understanding of power in church, and I want nothing to do with it. And then a few years ago, I was on a course where somebody said, the denial of power is one step away from the abuse of power. The denial of power is one step away from the abuse of power. And it really profoundly impacted me. It profoundly impacted me because I realized that actually I was denying power. And that made me more likely to abuse the power that I had, the very thing that I wanted to avoid. So it set me on a journey of thinking about power, thinking about my power and other people's power. And it set me thinking about this verse. So there are two things that I want to just offer. There's so much more that we could say about this, but there's two things about power, two statements about power that I want to say that I think actually spring from this passage. Firstly, everybody has power. We may not have equal power, we may not have the same kinds of power, but everybody has power. Jesus is recognizing that those that feel the most powerless in these, in three out of the four scenarios that he offers, actually do have incredible power to transform the conflict, the difference, or the disagreements that are going on in these scenarios. They have incredible power. They just don't see it. They feel powerless. And Jesus comes along to empower them, to see the power that they do have, and to help them transform these scenarios that Jesus is giving. I would say that everyone has power. We may not have equal power, we may not have the same types of power, but we have power, and that comes because we are made in the image of God. One of the first things that God does, as we read in the story of Scripture, in fact, the first thing that God says, let there be light. God has incredible power. Let us make man in our image. As people that are made in the image of God, we all have power. We all have the ability to change things, change our lives, change situations in which we're in. We all have that kind of power or influence or authority. Just after, in that Genesis story, just after God says, let us make, and human beings are made in the image of God, he then gives them a mandate. Fill the earth, be fruitful, multiply, and have dominion over it. It's a power word. Have dominion over creation. But that dominion, that power, was for the flourishing of all creation. It was that it would teem with life. It was for the flourishing of other people and other things. So God has power. We're made in his image. He gives us power, dominion, but for the flourishing of other people. We all have power. So the question, well, let me give an example. Because we might be thinking, oh, I don't have any power, or some people don't have any power. What happens if you're in captivity or in prison? You don't have any power. Well, let's take the most powerless, helpless thing that you can possibly imagine. A newborn baby. What happens when a baby cries? We all go running! Let me tell you, after three of them, a newborn baby has an incredible amount of power. Of a different kind, but it has a power. Everybody has power. So the question is not so much, do I have power? The question we need to ask ourselves in all kinds of situations is, what kind of power do I have? What kind of power do I have? And in the three examples where people might feel powerless, they still had some power of a certain kind. So, I know this is not usual for sermons, but I'd like you to buzz in pairs or threes. What kinds of power are there? What kinds of power are there? Where might we get power from? Okay? Anyone unclear about the question that you're just to talk to for a couple of minutes with your neighbour? Where might you get power from? What kind of power, kinds of power is there? Okay. So for those that were talking about power rather than what you're going to have for Sunday lunch, then, any ideas? What kinds of power are there?
Physical
power. Okay, as in your kind of physicality, your body, your strength, your... Yeah, excellent, thank you.
Emotional
power. Just say something about that.
As in having a kind of emotional hold over someone, the ability to hurt them.
Okay, so something about kind of your personality and your emotion, or actually there's something in there that you were saying about the way somebody else is relating to you that might give you that power as well. Okay, thank you. Sorry, let's go here and then here. Knowledge. Yeah, knowledge or expertise definitely is a source of power. Yeah, so how articulate you really are. Yep. Yeah, economic. Money is power. Money gives us some kind of power.
Status
or position, absolutely. So that for me was a really big one. I had shied away from church leaders having authority because I'd just seen abuse. So actually for me, just to come to a place of peace, this is a role that I have, and I need to recognize that there is some power in that. We'll come to the second point in a minute, which was the key question for me. But position, absolutely. Policeman. You run your own business. You have a position. You're a managing director or you're a manager in a company.
Image.
Say a bit more, Natasha, about that.
Just kind of how people, the way people dress, or if
yes,
not well dressed, they can look down on them and make them feel inferior.
Yes. Yes. So the way you dress can actually project a kind of image that can have some kind of power associated to it. Excellent. Nick.
Legal.
Again, just explain a little bit of what you mean there.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, so it's kind of where the law is on your side or using the law in some way for your advantage to coerce or manipulate. Yeah.
Technological.
Again.
Computer geeks.
So just say a little bit. Just say what you're meaning kind of there.
In today's day and age, people who are elderly or are not that up to date with modern technology, they can feel kind of a bit powerless, although they're older than us, kind of that, oh gosh, I don't know how to use this computer or this phone or what all these kids are doing.
So older people may not know how to use technology. I think what I hear in that is a combination of knowledge.
They don't know. There are many.
Yeah, yes, so some older people may know, but there may be some older people that don't. So there's something about knowledge there and also communication, I think. Other sources of power?
Race,
yes. Absolutely. Race and gender, I think, are two huge sources of power.
Political
power? Again, just say something about that.
Governments.
Okay, yeah. So actually, if you've got some kind of, I guess that's a bit of the legal thing as well, if you've got government leaders on kind of behind you, actually there's quite a lot of power that's associated with all of that.
Perception.
Who was that? Sorry, I missed that. Danuta. Yes. Yes. So how you perceive yourself and other people and the dynamics within that. Excellent. These things I've got up here were meant to just try and categorise some of the things that have been said here, and there may be other things as well. There's positional power. We've already said about that. There's a power of reward. We use that in parenting a lot. It's very powerful. If you tidy your bedroom, you can then have ice cream for dinner. Okay, but there is also the negative side of that, which is coercive power. If you don't tidy your bedroom, you will lose all screen time for the next 10 years. Yeah, it's called bribery, that's right. But the reality is that for many of us who work in organisations, we will have both reward and coercive power. If you don't do your job properly, you might lose your job. And I, as the manager, might sack you. That's coercive. Reward, I as the manager may suggest that you have a pay rise. So we have these kinds of power. There is personal power, which was my trying to lump together a lot of things around who I am as a person. My character, my ability to relate to people, my communication, my attractiveness, my race, my colour, my age, all those kind of things. Actually, there is power that is associated. My physicalness, there is power that is associated with all of those things. I was facilitating a group who were learning how to lead meetings, and this really tall chap, everybody was sat in a circle, this really tall chap was by a flip chart, standing over everyone. Part of the feedback he got from the group was it was quite intimidating because he was a man and tall and everybody else was seated around a circle and half of them were women. It was a very intimidating thing. It was a fascinating bit of feedback. So there is power in our physicality, in our gender, in our size. Expertise, which is knowledge. Knowledge and expertise about certain things gives us a sense of power. And the final one, resource. Money. Other resources, time. Gives us power. And spiritual, which nobody really mentioned. But God gives power. We're in church, eh? There's a whole lot of scriptures about God giving power. So there are these and maybe other sources of power. And I would suggest that we may not have, in some situations where we feel powerless, we may not have much positional reward or coercive power. And in our culture, we tend to see those things as power. But I want to broaden our understanding of power, and I think what Jesus does in these three examples to the person who might be a slave who's been slapped, he says, well, you don't have any positional power. You actually don't have any reward or coercive power. You have none of those other powers, but you do have other power. And can you see that power to actually rise up and change the dynamics in the relationship? It's brilliant. So, we all have power. The question is not, do we have power, but what kind of power do we have? The second thing I want to suggest that I think emerges from this passage is power is neither good nor bad, but it can be used destructively or constructively. So for me, recognizing that yes, there is a power that I have as a church leader, the question is, how am I going to use that power? It's also important for me to recognize that everybody has power, of all kinds of different types of power. But how am I going to use the power that I do have? And Jesus, in this passage, particularly in the final example of somebody who has quite a lot of resource power, he has money, he's able to lend and to give, but he has been wronged in some way. How is he going to use that power towards this person who has wronged him? And Jesus says, well, lend. Lend money without interest. Give without any expectation that it will be returned to you. Use your power constructively for the benefit of other people. And so we see in Genesis 1 and 2, I think, describe the fact that all human beings have power. Genesis 3 describes the fact that out of our brokenness, that power can be used destructively. And we see this most clearly in the relationship between the husband and the wife. As part of the fall, part of what happens when that brokenness in our lives come, to the woman, God says, your desire will be for your husband and he will rule over you. He will use the power that he has, maybe physical, maybe positional, maybe all kinds of things, but he will use that power destructively. He will rule over you. So the question is, how do we use the power that we have? I've been reading this book on humility called Humilitas, which is absolutely brilliant. I've really enjoyed reading it. And this guy defines humility like this. Humility is the noble choice to forego one's status, deploy your resources, or use your influence for the good of others before yourself. More simply, you could say that the humble person is marked by a willingness to hold power in service of others. And I think that's what Jesus calls us to. To recognize the power that we have and to use that power, those resources, that status, that position, whatever it is, for the benefit of other people. And in this passage, especially for the benefit of other people who have wronged us. Now, if I'm honest, that is enormously challenging. If somebody's wronged me, I kind of feel it's quite virtuous just not to retaliate. But Jesus is inviting us to use the resources, the power, the influence that we have for the benefit of other people. And he says that person, according to this definition, is humble. Wow. I had an old girlfriend many moons ago. She went to a different church, and her dad was a very fine, upstanding Christian doctor. And when he discovered that his darling daughter was going out with somebody who came to a church like this, he sent me an article called "The Love of Power or the Power of Love?" And it was really an exploration of charismatic theology. I actually really appreciated the article, and it was very balanced and very fair. But I remember the title 20-odd years later. In the article, it set up a contrast between these two things, power and love. But I want to say that those two things can coexist together, and that absolute power doesn't necessarily need to corrupt absolutely. And in fact, to prove my case, I want to bring exhibit number one, you lot. In fact, we are all proof that absolute power does not corrupt absolutely. Because when we were babies, our parents had absolute power. But not one of our parents murdered us. I think. I know maybe our parents have got some other things to answer for. But they had an incredible amount of power. But love, that desperate love for that small child, is stronger than the corrupting influence of power. What's the next passage that Jesus goes on to talk about in this Matthew chapter 5? Love your enemies. Love. So power doesn't have to corrupt absolutely when love is at work. And we are called to love those that hate us and persecute us, which we will look at when we get to that passage. Love transforms power. Love transforms powerlessness. Love for God, love for ourselves, and love for the others. I'd like to finish with a story of a Facebook friend of mine who I've never met and I don't really know, but he's a friend of a friend. He discovered a wee while ago that his wife was having a relationship with another person, which he didn't know. And his marriage, which up to that point he thought was okay, was breaking apart. He's now on the verge of divorce. He moved out of the family home. He's got two young children come to visit him occasionally and then go back to their mother. And it breaks his heart. His family home is up for sale. And he posted on Facebook the other day that his soon-to-be ex-wife called him and asked him to come round and hoover the house, as there was a viewing on their house which was for sale. And she had hurt her shoulder and she couldn't do it. And in the Facebook post, he said, "What should I say?" I wonder what advice you would give to him. He's got every right, not having heard her side of the story, admittedly. He's got every right to feel aggrieved, hurt, wounded, less than generous. And most of the comments on the Facebook thread basically seemed to tell her, to suggest to him, to tell her to get lost. One or two asked him, "What did you do?" And he said, "I went round and hoovered, of course." I suspect it cost him. I suspect it was really difficult and painful for him to do it. But he had power, a working shoulder that could hoover. He had every right not to do it. But I would say he walked out this passage. He used his power, even when it cost him, for the benefit of other people. I think when he did that, he walked down that narrow path. He chose to follow Jesus rather than the natural inclinations of his own heart. What I'm sure in his darker moments he was probably tempted to do. But he followed the way of Jesus, who invites us to recognize the power that we do have and to use that power for the benefit of other people. I'd like to just take a moment of reflection, and then maybe the band could come back. So just in a couple of minutes, just think about a relationship that you have. Friendship, somebody you work with, somebody who you work for, neighbor, family member. Could be a relationship where you think you have very little power, or a relationship where you feel you have a lot of power. Could be a relationship where there's some tension. I'm just going to ask a few questions, just to help us to reflect for a minute on the power that we have and how can we use that power for the benefit of others. So think about the power dynamics of this relationship. What is that like for you? And what do you think it might be like for the other person? What kind of power do you have? And what kind of power does the other person have? And finally, how is Jesus calling you to use your power in a non-violent, non-coercive way for the benefit of the other person? How is Jesus calling you to use the power that you have, the little or the lot, for the benefit of the other person?